This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
I'm Sharmila Ganesan, and welcome to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture, the eight-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they continue to matter today. In today's segment, we'll be looking at the making of Malaysian identities from the 19th century up to today. Over time, various people, from politicians to playwrights, have conceptualized Malaysia and the idea of Malaysians in diverse ways. And while Merdeka in 1957 marks the emergence of Malaysia as an independent nation state, this is really only part of a much more complex story. So to guide us through this, we have on Skype with us Sumit Mandal, Associate Professor in the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Nottingham, Malaysia Campus. Sumit, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to start off with, I would like to begin by thinking about the Malay world. This is quite an influential way of thinking about our region, and you've used it in your work as well. Why is the idea of the Malay world important in thinking about identity?
Well, the term Malay world helps us to view the history of this part of the world beyond the boundaries of nation states. So in order to have a more complex and multidimensional view of Malaysian identities, it's necessary to place the history of the peoples who constitute Malaysia in a much longer frame, and a frame that goes back to the times before the rise of nation states. So some of us use the term transnational history to describe this more exploratory kind of view of identities beyond national boundaries. And the term Malay world really helps us to achieve that goal.
Mm. And why is the 19th and early 20th century important within this lens of the Malay world?
Well, it's in the 19th and 20th centuries that we have, properly speaking, colonial states in this part of the world. So the Dutch and the British established themselves in the course of the 19th century. And in that period, they introduce racialized understandings of the population of this part of the world. And many of those racialized understandings, for instance, the common categories that are used to understand the Malaysian population till today, Chinese, Indian, Malay, and others, are racialized categories that were introduced largely in the 19th century. So the 19th century, for me, is a very interesting break in the long history of the region. And it's often not been understood very deeply. It's often the case that histories of a country like Malaysia begin largely from that moment in that 19th century, drawing from colonial intervention and colonial developments in the economy, in politics, and rather than placing the history of the people of Malaysia in a much larger, longer historical frame. So it's not about ignoring the 19th century and the rise of the kinds of racialized understandings that emerged then, but it's about critically engaging that. And one way of critically engaging that moment of colonial intervention is to place it in a longer history and in this more broader Malay world framework.
Could you describe some of the different types of textual material and visual sources that we can use to study how this identity making in this period happened?
Well, the types of materials that are available in the 19th century undergo a massive transformation. So in terms of the important sources constituted by Malay manuscripts, right? So handwritten texts that have been passed down or typically copied over and distributed across different courts in the region over hundreds of years. Some of those, that tradition persisted until the early 19th century. So you have manuscript traditions which you can refer to understand perspectives on the Malay world. And then in the course of the 19th century, you have the advent of photography and print. And by the end of the 19th century, you have, you know, fairly well established publications, printing presses. So, and by that time, you would have sources in English, in Dutch, colonial sources, as well as sources in Malay, in print. And those would constitute some of the variety of sources that you would have to refer to in the 19th century and right up to the early 20th century. But the voices of people who participate in producing these sources, becomes much more lively and varied in the early 20th century, when you have more people who are colonial subjects, you know, Asian colonial subjects who are producing print publications in Malay, in Chinese, besides the kind of dominant Dutch and British kinds of publications that are being produced by the colonial states.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the main ways in which this identity making, particularly when it comes to the racial categorization, census has played a pretty large role in it, didn't it?
Yeah, censuses were part of a range of state tools, so to speak, right? You also had the organization of people first by racial category, and then frequently, certainly in the Dutch colonies, by place of residence. So particular racial groups in would be confined to particular residential areas. So censuses become important in this larger, as part of this larger effort at organizing a complex and connected society into racialized blocks. So censuses, as a scholar named Charles Hirschman very famously has shown, were a kind of distillation from the point of view of the state of the way society looked. So for instance, you could have a census that looked at the categories of different people of Indian descent within the colony of Malaya. And, you know, one period you might have under those categories a breakdown that includes, say, Gujaratis and Tamils. And then in the next census, you would have the category Gujaratis drop off, and then you only have Tamils. And it doesn't mean that the people of Gujarati ancestry disappear, but the censuses, you know, due to decisions made by the census bodies, the representation of Indianness changes. So you have a more narrow understanding emerge as a result of the way in which the census projects what the ground realities look like. So this is something that persists. For instance, when we think of the understanding of Malaysian identities, contemporary Malaysian identities, in what is basically an old colonial formula, which is Chinese, Indian, Malay, other. In each of these categories, you have much, much greater complexity than what is represented, whether in public politics or in the overall census.
Mm. Now, the idea of these kinds of categories, obviously, it was something imposed by the colonial states of that time. However, I'm also interested to know about the kind of agency that the individuals that were being colonized had. I mean, did they have space to assert their own ideas of identity?
Yeah, as colonial rule introduced racialized understandings of the world, to be important in within colonial states, you found people organizing around these racialized understandings in order to be able to assert themselves. So imagine basically racialized understandings as a kind of new form of participating politically and so on. So by the early 20th century, you had groups emerging who represented ethnic or racially based understandings of themselves and created organizations around it and so on, because those were the terms of public participation.
Mm. I'd like to also explore a little bit about the terms and concepts that people of that era would have used to describe themselves. You know, for example, the different meanings for the terms that we use today, like, whether Malaysia or Indonesia or Nusantara, what would these words have meant for people of that era?
Well, first of all, these are words that are very, very recent, right? At least for us as historians, they don't go much further back than the late 19th century. They really develop in any kind of force in the 20th century. And frequently, they are terms that were initially imagined or coined by European scholars and observers of this part of the world. I think for many people, prior to the rise of the nation state, they would have had a sense of some kind of belonging to the individual colonial states. But for the most part, if we looked at the history of Malaysia under the British, you would have a very strong association with individual provinces, right? In somebody from Kedah, in the northern part of the peninsula, would have a very strong Kedahan identity. Mm. It wasn't until the early 40s when you had very expressed efforts to organize national-level Malay identity, and it took effort. It took a great deal of effort to bring representatives from different states together, different provinces together, to gather and begin to represent the idea of a Malay at the national level. And this is an really important idea for us to keep in mind, because too often understandings of identity are not historically constituted. So the idea is frequently presented to us that Malay, Chinese, Indian, others are, come as ready-made entities.
Mm. But, that is something that we tend to take for granted, especially because it's hammered into us from the time we register ourselves, But before these ideas became entrenched in what we now know as Malaysia, were there other ways in which individuals in the Malay world grouped themselves?
Yes. One of the ways in which people grouped themselves or were seen by others is captured by the term Peranakan, which I frequently use to translate. I've translated the term Peranakan into English as Creole. Mm. And you find that term being used in the different parts of the British, different areas ruled by the British in this part of the world that came to be constituted as Malaysia. It was used also in Java and other parts of the Malay world that became Indonesia. Peranakan is a very, very interesting term because it also helps us imagine a very different understanding of belonging and identity, because people who came to this part of the world from southern India and became the part of the fabric of society in Penang, for instance, let's take people from southern India who were Muslim and interacted intimately, you know, with Malay society in Penang. Their offspring, the children of the marriages, interactions of people from southern India and Malays in Penang were regarded as Peranakan. And people who were Peranakan were not just a mixed category, but for me represent an identity on their own, which incorporated elements of Malayness, elements of Indianness, which don't fit nicely into national boundaries or ethnic boundaries. But what's, I think, more important for us in terms of locating it within a longer-term Malay world framework is to see how these kinds of ways of identifying people and identifying belonging to a place does not fall into the kinds of racialized understandings introduced by the British.
Sumit, we do need to take a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to move this conversation forward into the 1950s and the post-independence era. So we will be back after a short break. You're listening to History on Repeat, where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they matter today. I'm speaking with Sumit Mandal, Associate Professor in the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Nottingham Malaysia Campus, about the making of Malaysian identities from the 19th century up to today. We'll be back after a short break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to History on Repeat, the 8-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and their importance today. I'm speaking with Sumit Mandal, Associate Professor in the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Nottingham Malaysia Campus, and we've been talking about the making of Malaysian identities from the 19th century all the way up to today. So before the break, we were speaking about the 19th and early 20th century. And now we will go on to the 1950s onwards and the history of post-independence Malaysia. Sumit, so, you know, today the nation state of Malaysia has a particular, a configuration that we're used to. And that's, of course, the peninsula. And then we have a portion of Borneo, which is Sabah and Sarawak. And we're all known as being Malaysian. But were there other ideas or visions of national identity that were proposed before independence?
There were different aspirations to nationhood in the period in the first half of the 20th century, including efforts to establish a more left-leaning understanding of nationhood, led by groups such as Kesatuan Melayu Muda, the Young Malay Union, and many of these groups sought an understanding of a more transnational view, one could say, that saw independence from colonial rule to be something arrived at through collaboration with other people in the Malay world. They use the term Nusantara, which is an old word to describe the archipelagic region for which I'm using the term Malay world. And as approaching the mid-20th century, when many independence movements were at their height, left-leaning groups in Indonesia and Malaysia sought a vision of nationhood that saw a future citizenry in the case of Malaysia, for instance, that would not necessarily be organized along racial lines. So there were visions of sort of citizenship which would have regarded all citizens, whatever their ethnicity, to be equal in the law, and whose foundational politics were more left-leaning and radical. In the mid-20th century, as these movements arose, the British saw them as a threat and put down fairly severe, they took severe actions against the left movements and made sure that they would diminish in power in the middle of the 20th century. And in many ways, the kind of movements that did eventually lead the country to independence were the movements that saw that had the approval of the British colonial rulers.
Mm. And what would you say was the movement that ended up defining Malaysia and Malaysian, the idea of Malaysians as we know them today?
Well, we're talking about the party, the United Malays National Organization, UMNO, mm-hmm. in combination with the Malaysian Indian Congress, MIC, and the party that represented Chinese, the Malaysian Chinese Association, coming together in what we know is a very traditional and official narrative of negotiating independence on behalf of Malaysians.
Mm-hmm. So it is then, it is somewhat tempting to think of that moment of independence as a break from the colonial past. But in some ways, especially in light of what we spoke about earlier and the establishing of these racial categories, is it instead just a form of continuity when we talk about identities post-independence?
No, I don't think it's a simple form of continuity, mm-hmm. Simply because independence was a very meaningful moment across the world. The term that's frequently used is decolonization. Mm-hmm. The era of decolonization from the 40s until the 60s, from Asia to Africa, was profoundly significant because it meant it meant that for the first time, Asians were ruling over their own countries. Citizenship was being given to the people of these regions by their own states. So the idea of self-determination was being established after decades of groups and movements, nationalist movements, struggling to achieve these goals. So it's not a simple continuity, but there is a continuity of colonial ideas, colonial state formations, as we move into the independent state. So to stick to our concerns here, the concerns of Malaysian identity, the whole idea of racialized understandings of the population is not really critically engaged after independence in Malaysia. And we see it instead being developed in perhaps even more sophisticated ways than under colonial rule. So in the decades that, in the decades which, especially the early decades of independence, when many Malaysian citizens saw a very promising future, some people could have seen a future in which racial categories would have mattered less. Instead, what we found in the course of, 5 or 6 decades after independence is the growing significance in the public political life of Malaysia of racial categories.
Mm. Now, as we celebrate, having acquired, in whatever way we might view it, this contested idea of Malaysia, Why do you think it's also important to think about the limits of national identity as well?
I think the limits of national identity are constantly being posed by the circumstances around us. Although we as citizens and through our socialization, you know, in particular nation states, are given to believe that we are members of a sovereign territory, you know, and in terms of Malaysia, belong to a society that is constituted by neat blocks of ethnicity. We are a country that is constantly in constantly part of transnational and global flows. The most obvious element of this is trade and the economy. And we, few people in Malaysia wouldn't be aware that the country is highly dependent on international trade, on international investment. And so in numerous ways, the idea of national limits is constantly being tested and being flaunted as well. Now, when we think about the constitution of the country, is it enough to be thinking about the country as constituted by Malaysian citizens alone when something like, I think the last time I looked, 5 million members, you know, of the population are foreign workers? And yeah, we could take a very official line and say, well, these are non-citizens and they don't count. But 5 million or more people are an intimate part, not just of the economy, but social life and cultural life in this country. So there are numerous examples that we could use to realize that we cannot, in not just in terms of sort of an academic understanding of history, see the country in terms of its national boundaries alone, but we have to constantly be open to a variety of different influences and keep our eyes open to seeing how numerous forces that can lie beyond the national boundaries are actually quite significant in the constitution of Malaysian identity.
So on that note, I just want to go back to you mentioning earlier that the hybridization, or rather the Peranakan culture, which you said is an alternative way of thinking about Malaysian identity. Now, where do you think that sits within this official narrative of independence in the nation state?
Well, it has a very marginal position, if at all, any position, because the tendency, at least in the official historiography, is not to recognize the Creole histories or Peranakan histories. But, you know, they are immensely well represented in political life and cultural life beyond the state. Unfortunately, people have also internalized ideas that are more racialized and more exclusivist, and as a result, have tended not to see Peranakan or Creole identities as being significant, but tending to romanticize or exoticize them, you know, in terms of food or clothing, you know. So everybody, I think, knows certainly in Malaysia or in Singapore about Peranakan food and so forth. But for me as a historian, Peranakan-ness, Creole identities, a very important reminder of ways of understanding identity and belonging that are, I think, very, very helpful to us in a world that is increasingly even more interconnected than the past. And if I may use an example of how fundamentally Creole or intermixed our histories are, and how much they might be, you know, this is erased from our official narratives. I'd like to refer to the example of the first Prime Minister of Malaysia, Tunku Abdul Rahman. He's a very interesting gentleman, and he's obviously in the official narrative understood as a very important founding figure in the nation and so on. But one aspect that is so significant about him was his Thai Malay biography. And that element, you know, beyond a few specialists and maybe family members and so on, is not widely known in public. And the Tunku himself, I find interesting, whatever one might think of his politics and so on. But I find interesting because of the candid way in which he talks about himself in his own published in autobiographies. And in it, you find that the Thai element of his biography is immensely significant. He certainly spoke some amount of Thai. And as part of the relationship of Kedah, the sultanate from which Tunku Abdul Rahman comes from, it was largely within a kind of Thai political orbit. As part of that history, he was sent as a child to study in Bangkok. And due to some personal circumstances that prevented him from continuing, he came back to Kedah and then was eventually put through the British system and sent to Cambridge to get his law degree and returned eventually to become a civil servant in the colonial period and become the first Prime Minister of Malaysia. But had things worked differently for him, he would have been a bureaucrat in the Thai civil service because that wasn't uncommon for Malay royalty from Kedah. So when we think about that example, right, we can see how very significant parts of Malaysia's national history have been erased, right? So it could be a really interesting challenge to be using the Tunku or the kinds of Peranakan histories I've been talking about to understand the more complex and multidimensional identities that actually constitute Malaysian identities.
And to bring this to our present moment, you know, what do you think are the limits of using this concept of race in how we think about Malaysian identity today?
Well, you know, it's become part of the political and social organization, and so it's in practical terms, sometimes it's very difficult for people to escape these categories, but they pose enormous limits to the country's potential, to the country's ability to be creative in numerous areas, and you know it. These racialized ideas impose constraints on people's imagination and abilities even because they limit for in certain circumstances and for certainly a number of people the desired level of interaction, right? Sometimes I taught for a long time at University Kebangsaan Malaysia, and I would teach histories and modules that looked at Malaysia in terms of its complex and intermixed cultural identity. And, you know, it wouldn't be unusual for me to encounter in a young undergraduate student an idea of race, for instance, that was quite delimiting, right? So you'd have, if I were to ask somebody of a particular ethnic group, well, you know, if you were faced with a situation in which you were to help a person of a different ethnicity in a situation in which that person was endangered, what would you do? And I've had, you know, a small number, not a large number maybe, who would come out and say, well, I wouldn't lend a helping hand. Mm-hmm. Now, so this is a kind of very limiting idea that racialized thinking can produce in the public political life, and beyond party politics, it obviously becomes part of Malaysian society. But I cannot end the story really with that, because in a lot of the work that I've done, I'm exploring numerous ways in which Malaysians either politely or quite openly go against this racialized formula, and to assist each other, to build on projects together. The arts in Malaysia is an area in which you find an enormous degree of interaction and creative work that doesn't rest on narrow ethnic boundaries. Mm. And I would say a lot of historically academic work, and given that we are speaking at a time when there is a global pandemic, we can see medical professionals rising up to the challenge of looking after Malaysian citizens again, both a group of medical professionals dedicating their lives to the important work of caring for citizens without concern for ethnic identity, and the medical professionals themselves coming from numerous different ethnic groups. So thankfully, the racialized ideas don't dominate, and they are contested, and they should be contested and negotiated so that we have more humane understandings of interactions, and also understandings of interactions, social and cultural interactions, that actually draw from the history of the Malay world, in which racialized identities as they are known today in Malaysia were non-existent.
Mm. Certainly, you know, in the course of working on this series, almost everyone that I've spoken to about various parts of Malaysia's past, that's really a thread that's come through very strongly, you know, from ancient Kedah up to the present, this idea of much more diversity than the national line would have you believe. I'm curious to know what you think the role of history education and the learning of our shared past could do. You know, how would it change the way Malaysians see ourselves and the future of the country?
I think it has a really important role to play. But the way in which I'd like to see it change would be not so much really in thinking about, well, you know, we need to include more about, you know, histories of particular groups. You know, it's not merely about increasing, representation historically. Of course, that can certainly be part of what history education does. But I really think history education can be very important if it is about, teaching people to think. That and one really important education that one really important lesson I think that history imparts is that the past is contested. The past is not something that rests on my point of view or yours. Yes, it's frequently determined by people in power because they have control over official narratives. But even under circumstances when that's happened, individuals, groups have constantly sought to represent other kinds of views. So in my own teaching and other work in public education, if I get opportunities to speak to the public, I think one of the things that I am most concerned in imparting is that we need history education that teaches us to see history as different kinds of views about the past in contestation. And I mean, that doesn't mean necessarily that anything goes, but the idea is to find historical resources, documentation, and so forth that proposes one idea, and also to be accepting of alternative notions. That's not something, although it seems so basic and essential, and something I think very few people in principle would disagree with, you will find that a lot of the debates about who belongs, who doesn't, whose faith is more significant and whose is not, you're basically seeing very, very defensive ideas about history. You're saying you are, you know, arguing for an idea of identity and belonging that's very egocentric. Right. So for historians, I think working in the classroom or writing in scholarly publications and speaking to the public, I think our biggest goal is really to be able to encourage an acceptance of multiple histories, multiple ways of understanding the past, and certainly in understanding a wonderfully complex society like Malaysia, we would have to negotiate many different understandings of the past.
Mm-hmm. You know, we are running out of time, but I would just like to end this with, I think, a question that is possibly not one that's easy to answer, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway. We are going through, you know, it's been a time of political change for us. And as you mentioned, we're going through this pandemic, this huge public health challenge. In light of all of this, you know, what do you believe it means to be Malaysian today?
I think it's actually a good question to ask now, because I think in times of crisis, and let's put the political transition that took place very recently aside, not out of fear of discussing that for any reason, but because that's something that, you know, though unprecedented and so forth, many people have spoken about. I'd like to maybe try to answer your question by looking at this pandemic. And, mm-hmm. You know, there are numerous things that the pandemic is doing, and it's forcing not just Malaysians, but many different people around the world to genuinely understand how deeply interconnected we are at this time. And for historians like me, we claim to be working on transnational, transregional histories. It's a way of grappling with world history. We are locating particular communities, national, local, and so on, in larger, in a larger global process of movement of people, goods, and ideas. And sometimes it's very hard to get across just how interconnected we are, and we have been historically interconnected, but we are even more so now on certain levels. And the pandemic really forces us to grapple with this, to understand how something that begins, a disease that begins in China, actually has an impact in Malaysia and then well beyond us. And so there's one way in which we are being forced to become level with other people around the world. But I think to come back to the question of Malaysian identity, what that means is that really, how much can you claim exceptionalism on behalf of being Indian, Chinese, Malay Muslim? You know that how much of the last decade's debates have been about claiming exceptionalism. And I think what the pandemic is doing is showing how such claims can be utterly meaningless in the face of the kinds of global unities that we have to face in, or processes that really don't differentiate between the kind of claims that we make. Now, this doesn't mean that these claims are going to end, because these are claims based on particular social groups, social interest groups, whether they are, you know, of Indian ancestry or Chinese ethnicity and so forth. But I don't, again, want to close with that. I want to say that in the face of that, right, so you have there this global pressure to recognize, hopefully many will recognize beyond their narrow vested interests, the level to which being human is the shared aspect of our identities and a very significant aspect of identities over and above being Chinese, Malay, Indian, and other. The way in which Malaysians are emerging to respond to the crisis, the global health crisis, for me is really quite defining. You have very important calls by Malaysians to serve the citizenry, serve the people who need healthcare at this time of crisis, to serve people who are in need generally, not just Malaysians. In fact, there's also calls to assist foreign workers who are also badly affected by the current crisis, and sometimes as non-citizens may not be a priority, but there are calls being made by Malaysians to assist those people. So for me, I think your question is a great one, because in the crisis is when, beyond any theorization on my part or anybody else's part, we are seeing an idea of Malaysian identity being lived. And that identity is crossing boundaries, is standing up for, looking out for other people within the boundaries of this nation state in ways that are immensely laudable.
That is, I think, indeed a lovely note to end on, and a very hopeful one at this time. Thank you so much, Sumit.
Thank you.
So that was Sumit Mandal, Associate Professor in the Faculty of Social Sciences at the University of Nottingham Malaysia campus. We've been discussing the making of Malaysian identities from the 19th century up to today. And that wraps up the 8th and final installment of History on Repeat, our mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past, and of course, why they continue to matter today. If you've missed any part of this interview or any previous segments, you can download the podcasts on bfm.my, on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.